Hi guys, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to SLWB's podcast series, Speakeasy. This episode of Speakeasy has graciously been hosted by Tamil Culture. Speakeasy aims to create a dialogue among the diverse communities that reside within Sri Lanka and spark an open conversation about those topics typically only discussed in closed circles. My name is Jessica J. Sudhasan. I'm a law student here in Toronto, Canada. And today I have the pleasure of interviewing Shankari Chandran, an author raised in Canberra, Australia, whose three novels, Song of the Sun God, The Phantom Limb, and The Barrier, all set in Sri Lanka, canvas topics such as identity, religion, class, war, family, and media suppression, to name only a few. Her first book, Song of the Sun God, has been very well received across Sri Lanka's communities, which would explain why it was recently shortlisted for the Fairway Gall National Literary Prize in Sri Lanka. Song of the Sun God has also been optioned by an exciting television and film company, and they hope to make a six-part television series out of it. And this, part one of my interview with Shankari, we discuss Song of the Sun God's exploration of Sri Lanka's colonial roots and their long-lasting impact on the island's conflict, the disconnect between Colombo and the rest of the island, Shankari's evolution from a social justice lawyer to a writer, and her experiences grappling with her identity as a diaspora Tamil growing up in Canberra, Australia. Shankari, welcome, and congrats on the planned TV series. That's very exciting.
Thank you for having me, Jess. We're very excited about it.
What is your hope for the TV series on Song of the Sun God?
You know, when I wrote the Song of the Sun God, I was writing for different audiences and for different purposes, but one of its purposes was to try to bring the Tamil story, the Tamil perspective, and that narrative of what had happened to the Tamil people over the last 70 years, and in particular throughout its 26-year-long civil war and the way that that war had ended. I wanted to bring that story to a wider audience so that it wasn't something that was simply thought about, seen, and felt by the Tamil people, but something that was thought and felt and seen by others. And television is a wonderful and powerful, it's such a powerful form of expression, and I hope that it will reach a much wider audience through its adaptation into a television series.
Song of the Sun God was published just this year in January 2017, and it begins in the 1930s with Rajan, a young Tamil boy from the north of Sri Lanka, and follows the evolution of his family over three continents and spanning eight decades. Typically, when people think about Sri Lanka's conflict, their memory goes only as far back as the 1980s, specifically July 1983, or Black July, as it's called, to refer to the state-endorsed anti-Tamil riots carried out by Sinhalese mobs across the island, which saw the murder of over 3,000 Tamils, the looting and burning of Tamil businesses and homes, and which was, in large part, the catalyst for the massive exodus of Tamils from the island. Black July is often cited as the start of war in Sri Lanka, but in Song of the Sun God, the story begins in 1932, 50 years prior. Why did you decide to start the story there?
A lot of us do pinpoint the moment that the war began to Black July, and that is it's a story and a sort of historic context that is used by different groups within the Sri Lankan community, both Tamil and Sinhalese. But I think actually it's the origin of that conflict started much further back, and it was fascinating to me and really important to me to try to explore where that conflict really came from and how far back did it originate, to look at that time of when the British were leaving, what was happening in the nation, what was the narrative that existed in the public space, and where did this idea of identity, of the Sri Lankan identity versus the Tamil identity versus the Sinhalese identity, when did it begin, how did it begin, who was responsible for it? And so much of that seems to have started actually not even in 1930, but probably before then, with this the rise of, or with the impact of colonialism and the way the British had brought together different kingdoms as one administrative nation, and then the effect that that has on different communities and cultures, and in particular the effect that that had on this kind of nascent rising Buddhist nationalism, and then using that created a concept of the other, you know, Sri Lanka for the Buddhists, and then this idea that there were these other communities that were not actually ancestrally part of Sri Lanka or entitled to a place within Sri Lankan society. Mm. To put that present day conflict in its historic context, and that's, I think, is a really important exercise for any community to do, for any country to do, to understand where they are now, and the causation, I suppose that's the lawyer in me looking at what is it that actually caused that conflict and when did it really begin. And, you know, for the citizen within me to explore at what points along the way could that conflict have been diverted into a different outcome.
You had mentioned just a little while ago the lawyer in you. You were not always an author. In a previous life, you were a lawyer, and you still are a lawyer. Could you tell us a bit more about your background and what led you to writing, and specifically writing about Sri Lanka?
I'm laughing because I think my children still think that I function as a lawyer, even in the maternal parenting mummy context. So I studied law. I went on to do, as many law students do, I ended up working for a large law firm. But throughout my law degree and throughout my life, and I think very much as a function of who my parents were as people, I was always very interested in social justice issues, and was fortunate enough when I began to work for a large international corporate law firm, I ended up running their social justice program. And so I ran Alan Overy's pro bono program for 10 years, and that was a wonderful opportunity for me to engage in justice issues using the resources and the skills of a corporate law firm. We then moved from London back home to my home in Australia, and it was the first time really since my late teens that I had stepped out of the workforce, you know, stepped out of the paid economy, and was then very focused on our four children. So we'd had our fourth child by the time we'd moved back to Australia. And I had secretly, like many lawyers, always wanted to write a novel, and always felt that there was, you know, one novel within me, and thought, well, let's use this opportunity of unemployment to give that a go. And I started, I tested the waters by blogging for just for myself, really, as a kind of cathartic way of trying to make sense of this migration that we had foisted upon ourselves. We had chosen to re-migrate from London back to my home of Australia. And I was in Australia now for the first time since my 20s, realizing that Australia didn't actually feel like home anymore. And so almost as therapy, I began to blog about this. And the blog got picked up by a lifestyle website here, which then gave me the confidence to develop my writing voice, which then gave me the confidence to begin that first great novel. You know, the first great novel I'd always wanted to write was this exploration of the Tamil story. And I wrote a plan for this first novel, and then in 2012, and then I cleaned out my garage, as you do, and found a box of papers that I'd had from 1999, which was the year I moved to London. And in that box of papers was another plan for a novel that I had intended to write in 1999. And I kid you not, the 1999 plan and the 2012 plan were almost identical. And so clearly this novel had been sitting in my mind and in my heart for over a decade, waiting for an opportunity and waiting for me to have the courage to give it a go. And the novel, as do all of the three novels really, they do explore the themes of justice that I worked with when I was a lawyer. And I think that that's probably something that is very important to me as a person, as a lawyer, and as a writer. My publisher, Pan McMillan, said it so beautifully to me one day, my editor there. She said, oh, I think that your writing, when you write fiction, you're actually trying to right the wrongs. You're trying to fix mm-hmm. the wrongs that you were trying to fix when you were a lawyer. And I think that's quite right. I'm trying to right the wrongs in a way.
An interesting character in Song of the Sun God is Nala, who is Tamil herself, but having been socialized among Colombo's elite circles, initially has a very different perspective on the conflict and on the severity of it for the country. That story, that of a Tamil not from the Northeast, isn't one that's commonly explored in the few books that do exist on the topic. For the most part, they've tended to focus on the lives and the stories of Tamils from the Northeast. What was Nala's story meant to highlight, and why was that perspective one that you felt was important to look into?
The Nala's perspective for me was interesting because, you know, she is Tamil. She is personally and culturally invested in the North and the East, and historically has come from there. But she chooses to ignore what is happening around her. She chooses to benefit from this wonderful life that her marriage and that she and her husband have created for themselves in Colombo 7, and to continuously deny, you know, until it's undeniable, until it is absolutely undeniable, she continues to deny what's happening around her and the suffering of the people in the North and the East and the inevitability of that war and the way that it will ultimately affect both her and the people that she cares about the most. And in choosing to deny it, she actually exposes herself and her family to far greater danger than had she have tried to address it earlier on. And I think in Sri Lanka for a long time, and not, you know, this is not certainly not just the Tamil people or Sinhalese people, but we as Sri Lankans chose to ignore a lot of what was happening around us, particularly in Colombo, where it is easy to ignore it and where there is this disconnect between Colombo and the rest of the country. And it's not just this disconnect between Colombo and the North and the East. There is this disconnect between Colombo and the south of Sri Lanka. And there is a disconnect between Colombo and the center of Sri Lanka. And each of those disconnects has very profound political consequences, both for the people in those different regions, but for the country as a whole. And so with Nala, what I was trying to examine was what happens when you don't acknowledge the injustices that are being done to people in the rest of your country. And in Nala's case, her choosing to deny and to ignore eventually means that she is ultimately hurt. She is hurt. Her children are hurt. And she can't escape it. And whereas had she have tried to acknowledge it, or had she been courageous enough to acknowledge it, she actually may have been able to protect her family better.
That disconnect that you mentioned between the various regions of Sri Lanka is, I think, important to note, because often Sri Lanka's conflict is broadly characterized as simply an ethnic conflict. But in a lot of ways, the issues are much more complex than that. They go along regional lines as well.
They do. There's regional issues. There's class issues as well. When you go to the south of Sri Lanka, you see a very different socioeconomic Sinhalese population who don't necessarily feel that Colombo speaks for them. But Colombo does actually choose to speak for them. And in many ways that they think that their experience, Colombo thinks that its experience is the experience of the nation. And it thinks that what it does, what it says, what it feels is what's happening and what's going on in the rest of the country, whereas actually it's not. You know, when I was there in January 2017, I was fascinated by this really strong narrative that was coming across from people that I was interviewing of a certain socioeconomic group, of a well-to-do socioeconomic group, that everything in the country was fine now. You know, that the country was rebuilding its economy, that everyone was sharing of this tremendous post-conflict bounty, that the frustrations, the resentments, the injustices were all of the past, and that we were now rebuilding a unified, strong Sri Lanka, or a one country, a one nation. But, you know, if you were to then go to the North and the East, you were seeing something very different. You were seeing, certainly when I was last there in 2014 in the North and the East, you were seeing a country where the investment, the financial investment, was going into military and hospitality facilities that were run by the military. So hospitality facilities were being run by the military, which I found really, you know, actually very uncomfortable. there were these tremendous memorials to the wall being built. But if you were a Tamil person looking at those memorials to the war and to the victory, as it were, you would feel really alienated by those. And I felt alienated, and I wasn't born and raised in Jaffna, but I felt alienated. So I can only begin to imagine what these enormous monuments to a purported victory would make Tamil people feel like in their own, in their ancestral villages and lands. So much of the villages that we visited were had not been there was no money being put into reconstructing them at that time. 2014, we went to visit the villages that my parents came from, and it just told a different story. And I remember speaking to Tamils there, and they would say, "Well, I would say, are you happy? How do you feel? Are you comfortable?" And they would say to me, "Well, if you're happy to be a second class citizen in your own country, then yes, we're happy." And I thought, well, is that the future that Colombo speaks of is being built, and is that the future that we want? And then on my last trip, I went to the south, and when you're driving through the south, as we did, because I was researching my third novel, which a big portion of that is set in the south, you are seeing actually quite great poverty. And so, again, I don't know that Columbo necessarily understands that or speaks for that or feels that. And I think that that disconnect is something that needs to be addressed and explored more. Otherwise, you'll have what's ultimately a very small island, what's geographically a very small island, but that will still be a fractured small island.
There is a moment in the book between two characters, Smriti and Prashanth, where they reflect on their identity and what it means to be Australian Tamil. It brought to mind a poem I read a while ago by Indrani Balaratnam, and in it she says, "It's a life that might have been. It's a home I don't know at all, a town so far away, and yet a strange familiarity lingers." That sentiment, that feeling of a strange familiarity, is one that I think so many of the diaspora can really resonate with. That feeling of knowing where you're from, what village you're from, but not quite knowing it, belonging to something, but not quite belonging. You were raised in Canberra, Australia. How has your identity been shaped by that gray area of belonging to something, but being removed from it at the same time?
That's a beautiful poem, Jess. I'm going to look that poem up later. That sense of identity and belonging and longing to belong has been a part of my life and my brother's life since, from the very beginning. We grew up in a very white Australian city, and the Sri Lankan community and the Tamil community there was very small. And what it meant was that, during the week, my brother and I would have this very white Australian life. We would go to school, we would hang out with our white Australian friends. We were slightly, if not very different from them in many ways. On a Friday night, we'd be going to temple, which was really just reconstructed out of a scout hall. We would be our eating, our traditions, our Thursday morning prayers. Everything was different from our white Australian friends, but children are generally very accepting. They were intrigued by the Sini Sambal sandwiches that I would be bringing in my lunchbox. They would trade me for them, and after they got over the initial smell, children were trading me for my chicken curry and all my Sini Sambal sandwiches. And it was, that was our life during the week. And then on the weekends, we would retreat into and live almost this double life, where we would then be a part of a very small Sri Lankan Tamil community. And so we had these sort of almost two lives, but never being fully a part of one or the other. And I think in many ways it sort of drives you as children, as siblings, and as cousins closer together. So for those of us in the, and I think this is a very common diasporic experience, we are very, very close to our cousins because our cousins were understood exactly where we were as misfits between two communities, and we only had each other, and we had to look after each other, and we often had to make excuses for each other or be alibis for each other. But we were that community that understood how we didn't fit into either. It's been a real transition for me from childhood, where I have at times really tried to reject the strictures of that Tamil upbringing, and I have deliberately tried hard to reach for the white Australian part of my life. And then as I got older, I did gravitate more towards my Sri Lankan Tamilness and towards that community. And when I moved from Canberra to Sydney, where there was actually a much larger Sri Lankan Tamil community, and there I was able to find like-minded friends. I was able to find Sri Lankan Tamil friends who'd had the same upbringing as me, who felt that same discomfort as me, and there was the safety and friendship in numbers. And it was a revelation. It was just so wonderful to feel that sense of kinship and that sense of understanding within that Sri Lankan Tamil community in Australia, in Sydney. And then as I've now in my 40s, I have my own children. And, you know, when you ask me, what am I, who am I? The way we teach our children now to answer that question is we say that we are Australian of Sri Lankan Tamil ancestry. And we are trying hard to be responsible citizens in a global community. And each of those different stages of that answer are really important to me, Jess, because I have made my peace now, I think, with the sense that I have traveled the world, I have lived and worked in different countries, I have lived and worked in different social justice issues that affect different countries and yet actually universally affect all of us as human beings. And so I feel much more comfortable with the multiplicity of my identities and the multiplicity of my values and perspectives and the potential richness that that brings to the world. And so I want my children to feel that they are in Australia, that they will be raised in Australia, and that they will contribute to Australian society, and that Australian society offers them a refuge and an opportunity in which to be free and safe. And therefore, they are Australian, and they are of Sri Lankan Tamil ancestry, and that ancestry is a present, a alive, and rich part of their life. And it strengthens them. It gives them important values, and it is not something that is simply of their past, but it is values that they will take into their future.
You've been listening to SLWB's interview with Shankari Chandran, the Australian Tamil author of three novels, The Song of the Sun God, The Phantom Limb, and The Barrier, which explore the past, present, and future of Sri Lanka through the various issues that reside at the root of Sri Lanka's conflict. You can get your copy of Shankari's novel, The Song of the Sun God, via her website, shankarichandran.com, and also through Tamil Culture's online marketplace, TC Market. This has been part one of my interview with Shankari. In part two, we discuss her third book, The Phantom Limb, as well as media suppression in Sri Lanka, the current state of political activism among the diaspora, the role of literary fiction in countering political fictions, her hopes for Sri Lanka's future, and we finish with a lightning round so that you guys can get to know Shankari a little bit better. Stay tuned.